So from the book writing perspective, AI, it only has access to what is already in the soup, right?
Yeah.
So AI could write a book on like the history, maybe you could write that history of firefighting book.
Yeah.
You know, if all those books have been in, have been submitted to AI, it has access to all that content and all those articles that have been written, you know, it could probably do a pretty good stab at writing the history of firefighting. But what it can't do is tell me Eric's life story.
When all is, play my cards right.
This podcast exists because of the team at CASCM. At CASCM, we make content creation enjoyable. We are on a mission to help leaders create content, content that will improve lives, content to be proud of, content that fosters community. We know through firsthand experience how content brings people together, and we love helping make that happen. We produce podcasts, short-form videos, blog posts, and other written works, while also providing support in website development, social media management, and strategic planning. And we would be excited to help you. Visit CASCM.com to learn more, or feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter.
Well, it's good to meet you. I appreciate you coming on, taking the time to chat. I'm very excited about this.
Yeah, likewise. I'm just shutting down my notifications all around. I think I've got most of them.
Yeah. I shut notifications down on my computer, and then somehow they still find their way in. I'm like, what's happening? I don't have a lot of notifications either, but they still make it.
Well, then Slack also has this like emergency button where you can like force the notification.
Right, right.
And 9 times out of 10, there's no way it should have been forced. I'm like, why did you do this?
It should not have gone through. Is it Slack or is it the other person that's doing it? Or you don't know?
It's the other person that's doing it, but like you get an option, like this person has paused notifications, and then they get an option like push it through or...
Yeah, this is super important, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it never is.
It's kind of nuts how many notifications there are. I mean, like the default settings should actually come through on your iPhone with no notifications.
Yeah, yeah. I'm constantly, like, I think I got the phone, I figured out a way of doing like a universal silencing. But yeah, I mean, there's so many times during the day where, and it's like every single day, I just like block off, like on Slack and other features, I just block off like 2 hours so that I just don't hear it at all, because it's too my ADD brain is way too, like, you know, always trying to multitask, and that it's not good. Even just hearing it, like even just hearing the background, I just know that I'm missing something, and it's already kind of making my brain work in two different places. And so anyway, so I'm that guy that just like blocks off giant sections, like you're just not going to hear from me for the next 2 hours.
Yeah. It's amazing that the world can continue, right? Without like needing everyone's input all the time. Like you could take time off, right? So, yeah. Well, I mean, it probably goes to your, I don't know, like if someone's being creative. Like the worst thing is to get interrupted, especially when you finally hit that mode. I guess they could say the flow state.
Sure. Yeah.
As soon as you get interrupted, it's like, I don't think I can get back to where I just was. Right.
Right.
And was that maybe where you come from when you think about it that way? Because obviously it's something that you've put some mindset into.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think it's similar, you know, because like I don't do what a lot of people consider creative work that much right now anymore. During my work, I'm not doing editing or writing or things like that. But I do think entrepreneurship is creative by nature. And so a lot of times when you're in a zone and you're thinking through like, okay, how do I solve this problem? And you're thinking through ideas and you're in that zone. I mean, it definitely... It's hard to get back into that zone sometimes, you know?
And
if you get separated, if you're in a train of thought, I'm trying to get a lot better about just finishing, like having enough time to finish a task from beginning to end. I mean, you can't always do that, but as best as possible.
Sure.
Just because it takes so much work and effort to just catch yourself back up to speed again. And sometimes you're just not in that zone. And so, a lot of times I just, if I don't block everything off, I'm not going to get into the zone and not going to accomplish what I need to accomplish. And if you put it off to another day, it's just like, just the chances of success go down dramatically. The chance of you putting it off for yet another day go up dramatically.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I heard you say, I think it was in a podcast interview you did, that you went remote. I want to say the year is 2007. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay. Has that been, as the thing that we're talking about right now, has that been a big part of like just for you for focusing, or like, what came to mind for you at that point, 2007, to say, I'm going remote? Like, what caused it? And like, how do you feel about it today?
Like, I was always remote.
Yeah.
I did a lot of different jobs, a lot. Everything from tree planting to, I was an outfitter for moose and bear hunts up in like the middle of nowhere, Canada. I did lifeguarding. I was a teacher. I was doing all kinds of stuff. You know, it's interesting, I guess. I was homeschooled for a time, and it was one of the first schools that was totally online. And this is like in 95, you know, like we're talking really early.
Yeah.
And we had the first version of Macintosh, right? Like that was like the first Apple personal computer and had like its version of Windows or whatever. But anyway, long story short, I did do some school that was remote, and you know, it was homeschool, but it was like dealing with teachers and stuff that were remote. I went back to a school, a very small school. Where I grew up is very low population, very,
yeah.
I mean, my school had 5 people in the graduating class. Actually, you only had 3 because 2 didn't finish.
Two didn't make it, yeah.
But, you know, I went to college and all that stuff, and all my jobs were, none of them were remote, except for I had one job that I was building high school curriculum, and that was remote, where I was kind of just building this curriculum for English. And that was, it didn't seem odd to me because I was used to that remote environment. And it was like junior high where I was doing remote work. And, you know, it was, and it was like remote. I mean, the teacher was thousands of miles, well, maybe not that, hundreds of miles away, thousands of kilometers. And you'd send them the assignment. They would hop on a call with you to discuss it. I mean, it was really like, today it sounds like very normal, but back then it wasn't very common. But then when I started the company in 2007, at first there was a hot moment where it was in person. That's when we were still tutoring. I was sending people to meet with people in person tutoring, but it wasn't for very long because it was shortly thereafter where someone approached me online and just said, look, I don't want to get in person tutoring. I just want you to look over my stuff and give me some feedback about what I can do to improve it, how I can change it. And it was that moment where, yeah, definitely the light bulb went off and it was just like, okay, let's, and you know, PayPal was around so I could just take payments easily. Credit card.
Yep.
And so we moved online. Yeah, it was definitely 2007. We moved everything online and just got out of the whole in-person. I mean, we still would meet clients in person, but I got out of the whole in-person tutoring thing. But back then it wasn't books or anything at that time. It was all just editing, tutoring. We were doing everything like resumes and all kinds of stuff. And then it wasn't until a couple years later, not long, maybe even a year or two later, that some hybrid publishers came, you know, essentially vanity presses came and wanted book editing. And yeah, that's where everything kind of changed into that direction.
Yeah. And I want to get to that part. So as far as working, so you have offices all over the country and the world. I mean, you have London now, and I want to touch on that as well.
Yeah.
So your staff, right? People, are they hybrid? Are they working? Are they going to the office when they need to? Are people there, you know, 9 to 5 type of thing? Or what does that look like?
Yeah, so it's kind of a combo.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, brick and mortar offices in New York, Nashville, LA, and then we just opened up in London like last year, so 23. And most of those offices have people, especially New York, have people in it every day.
Okay.
That go and do the full 9 to 5 thing in-house. But that's a definite minority of the team.
Okay.
And so, you know, most of the people still do work from home offices. These are all W-2, like not freelance. These are like full-time workers that are working from home offices. We'll bring them into the offices for meetings and stuff if clients come to meet with us. So we often do book planning sessions in person. So we'll bring in, like the client will come in and meet with us. The writer will be there. The editor will be there. Sometimes 2 editors, depending on the project. And we'll all meet in person for a couple days in a row. And we'll meet at one of the offices. But day-to-day typical workday for most of our team is all remote.
Okay.
Except for a minor few who correspond every day. Now, that's our core team. That's our core team of W-2s. We're about 30 W-2s. But we also have a couple hundred contractors that we're working with as well.
Yeah.
And these people are coming in. They might come into the office to meet with, you know, for that strategy session, the book planning session. But otherwise, we're bringing them in for specific projects. It's often writers.
Yeah.
So we have a book on the history of firefighting. You know, we'll want a writer who has a lot of experience writing on that subject. And so we just don't have someone in-house that's just going to be able to just be an expert on that. So
sure.
When it comes to the writing, we'll often bring in a freelancer for that part of it, but then it's all overseen by the team, and the editor is like the lead on the project, making sure that everything's looking good for the big picture and that it's moving forward in a way that's going to be a really good marketable book that's going to serve the client's need.
Yeah. Are the ghostwriters typically contract workers, or, I mean, maybe they do multiple, or are they only coming in, to your example before in the firefighting situation, where they're only going to come in probably for one book and then off they go? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, good question. It's a real mix. So we have probably about 100 writers that are doing 3 to 5 books a year for us. Or I should say like 1 to 5, but they're like regulars, especially people that are in like the business leadership categories, health, personal development. Like those writers, we have a lot of work for them because we get a lot of those projects in. And also like certain business writers can do a number of different books in that category without being an expert in like SAS or something.
Right.
And
right.
So same with like memoir, like celebrity memoir. A lot of those, we have people that are just really good at telling people stories. And, you know, as long as it's not something that's really technical or delves into a topic that's really niche, a lot of those writers, we can work with them on multiple projects at once. So a lot of our writers will work with us. And, you know, even though they're freelancers, we might be their only source of work, but they're still, like, by IRS standards, a freelance worker. Because they could take, they, you know, at any given moment, they could take...
They go write their own book or take another task. Yeah,
they work on their own machines. They work at their own schedules. It's just a contract. It's one-on-one freelance work. But some of them, we just keep busy enough that they really just work for us. But others, like military history, like there's a guy, I'm just thinking of him right now. He's, you know, he's kind of our military history guy. But we only get like one of those every year or two, you know, that's really military history. You know, and when those projects come in, you know, he's always our first call. But yeah, so there's definitely some of those that just kind of come in now and then. And they're kind of on the list, but we don't use them regularly, whereas others we're using all the time.
Yeah, that brings up the whole freelance economy, right? The future of work and what is this going to look like? And it's multiple streams of income. Someone doesn't have to have one job. They could have many jobs, right? Or maybe they have a core job, but they're doing other things. As you're leading this organization that's growing, that's gone worldwide and all these things, like how do you, you obviously see it that way to say, hey, we can have contract workers and we can get a lot done that way, as opposed to, I don't need every single person to be a W-2 employee that answers to my calls that we have to send computers to, kind of to your point you were saying before. Like, do you see that trend continuing with more companies and more companies getting into this whole freelance economy, or where do you stand with that?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's funny though. I feel like we got into this all backwards. Like it was like, for me, it was always freelancers at first. It was all freelancers and it was all remote. And this is obviously pre-COVID, like 2007, and everything was 1099s. I was the only employee of the company, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we set it up like an S-Corp and just, you know, everyone was a 1099 and I was the stability, like I was the front person and obviously everything hinged on me. But yeah, and everything was all remote. And then, you know, it's funny because as the world was going in one direction, I actually started pulling back into another. Like I started to really see the value of having W-2s, like the value of having people that are there every day for you, that learn your system, that learn your company, that you can depend on in a pinch. We ran into certain situations where we needed, you know, we were on a bad deadline and you needed something done quickly and you really needed it was so much better just have an expert in-house.
Right there.
Just come in and do it. And you knew you could rearrange their schedule any way you wanted or needed to get the job done. And also just having that like in-house stability in terms of talent. Like it was quite a few years. I don't know. I think we started hiring in-house editorial talent around 2016. Before then, it was just all freelance based. We had a couple kind of project manager type people in-house, like answering the phones, doing like stuff that you really need someone there every day for. But when we started hiring talent in-house, and talent in this case was editors, like book editors, specifically book editors from the big houses, like someone who spent their whole career at Penguin Random House. Like we wanted them to be in-house so that we could market that to our clients and basically give our client an in-house talent person that would be responsible for the book and that really knew the industry inside and out and could provide their expertise and that they knew was always going to be here. You know, it wasn't something that was just farmed out. So anyway, so around 15, 16, we really wanted to move that shift. We really made that shift to just make sure our most important assets were in-house. And that also was like something of value that people, you know, if you're just a freelancer hub, and you know, this works for a lot of businesses, but like the value is just in the connection, right? The value, there's nothing in your company that's the value. So we wanted to make sure we had a product in our company, which is our talent, our in-house talent and experience and expertise that was really in the company that people were coming to and that were getting that, you know, they knew it was there and that they weren't just getting farmed out to somebody else.
Sure. That's a little bit of the best of both worlds there, right? Like to be able to do both. And like you said, to go in a different direction when everyone's going this way, you're going the other way, which you've done twice, it sounds like.
Yeah. And even with in-house stuff, like even with like brick and mortar, like when COVID hit and everyone, at that point, it was funny because everyone was going remote and we'd already done a lot of remote work, but then, you know, everyone was now doing it.
Right.
And Zoom became a big thing. Like, you know, before COVID, we would often do our meetings just on phone calls and stuff. And then for some reason, Zoom, I think, took off because people wanted to still see people's faces in every single meeting. And that became like the standard. Like now we have to, because before that, we were doing all our meetings remote. And we never had to be on the camera. You know, it was just phone calls. And then all of a sudden COVID hits, everyone goes home and everyone needs to be. And that was just the expectation. It turned into like, you have to be on a video call. And so our whole team had to, you know, we changed. Like all of us now were on video calls because that was now the expectation. But I really thought that a lot of things suffered when everyone went remote. Like just, it's hard to work in teams. It's hard to have the energy of a room when you have people working together in the same room. Like our model was always, whatever you can do in person that's better in person, if it really is elevating it, do it in person. And so we would always be traveling or bringing people into the office to get, especially the book planning phase. Like when someone's pouring their heart out about their super sensitive stories or their big idea, or they're really trying to brainstorm and figure out, and you're trying to draw out like, what's their story? What's their idea? Like, and you're having this conversation, especially if it's more than a one-on-one, it's not ideal to be just looking at a square on your computer, you know?
Yeah.
Having people in three-dimensional space, feeling the energy of a room, being able to meet together for longer periods. I mean, a 90-minute Zoom is like really long, right?
I mean, yeah.
You get people getting tired. People feel stuck in one place. They can't move around. You know, the value of being in person, we thought was really, really important. And so when everything went to Zoom, that changed a lot for us. I mean, we used to do these meetings where we'd meet with clients all day, 2 days in a row to really hammer something out and figure it out together. And now on Zooms, you just can't really do that. You can't meet all day in a Zoom.
No.
And it just really, I think it really hurt people's ability to work productively together and feel each other's energy and really come up with great creative content. So as soon as the COVID restrictions started to die off, we were really pushing people to come back to the office and we were having a hell of a time. Like no one wanted to go and meet in person.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to just do Zoom meetings. And honestly, it hurts the process. It really does hurt the collaborative process to force it to a digital meeting.
Yeah. I even heard like when kids were looking at college and they're starting this process just like this past year, and you would talk to people on college campuses, they're having a hard time getting the kids to come and participate in activities outside of the dorm because they're so used to taking classes online, right? Things have changed so much. No different than business. I remember I had a call and I called the individual we had scheduled. I hadn't talked to him before. And he says, oh, I thought we were going to do a Zoom call. I was like, I thought we could just like go back the old school, right? And just have a phone call. And I could walk around outside and enjoy myself. You know, but to your point, like it was so the expectation. But yeah, it becomes very difficult to have that, to build that vibe like you were talking about. You also touched on in an interview and you referenced it earlier today, like it started one way and then it got into ghostwriting. It got into other aspects of your business. Like, that's a difficult thing to do, right? Because you had set out for this vision.
Right.
People had expectations, to use your word, of what your business was going to look like. And then, I don't know, was it a result of people reaching out to you, said, hey, you know what? I don't want to meet with you. I just want some feedback. And you know what? I actually don't want to write the book. I just want to talk to someone and I want them to write the book. Like, was it the market telling you what the next step was for your business? Was it multiple little things that happened that you said, oh, wait, we have to go in this direction. That's the new vision. Like, what did that look like?
Yeah, I don't think the market changed, really. The book market was there before we entered into it. I think it was just realizing opportunities and jumping on them. And I think just recognizing, hey, this sounds like I could do a lot more online than in person, like just how you can grow that business and how much easier it is to run than sending tutors in person to house for 1 or 2 hours at a time. That just made sense. And I guess the value or the message there would just be not to hold on to your ideas about what you want to do with your business. Because you know, we thought it was a tutoring business. Then we realized, you know what, editing is a lot easier and better margins. You get less complications, less logistics to deal with, and we can all work from home. You know, it sounded, I mean, why wouldn't you do that instead of this tutoring thing? So just letting go of that to go for what made more sense. And it was a lot of shifts. I mean, we went to the editing thing, and then, you know, we started to do a lot of things like resumes and all these things. And we realized that that was just getting too, like, we were just diluting our market. It was getting harder to advertise. You know, it's a lot easier to focus on a niche and like really own it rather than doing everything. But what happened there was, so we were doing a whole lot of things and then a lot of smaller stuff, right? Like $100, $200 orders, right? Per client. And then a Vanity Press came to us and said, Vanity Press is like a book publisher that just publishes, it's a pay-to-play publisher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rich business person pays them to make sure that their book gets published and that they can make themselves a published author, but they paid for the whole process.
Sure.
They came to us and said, hey, we're having a heck of a time with our freelance editing. Like the quality control is, it's not there. And we really just need really great editors. And we had all Ivy League, Harvard, PhD, English doctoral students or professors, et cetera, on the team. So they saw that as something that, you know, who else would be better to edit, you know, these manuscripts than a Harvard PhD in English. And so when they came to us, we had never edited a book before. And they came to us asking about, and I just seized the opportunity, like, you know, it just made so much sense. I mean, it wasn't anything genius about it at all. I mean, they came to us. I mean, you know, just look at the numbers. I mean, you got a longer piece. So it was a higher price per item. Obviously, we could do it. I mean, it was similar. We had to shift and figure out, okay, well, which editors? And again, at this time, it was all freelancers. So I could find freelancers that were good book editors as long as I could pay them and make a margin off of what I was charging. And I was the quality control in the middle. It was the same model, just had to find a different service provider, different freelancer to make sure I could do it. But on the surface, you know, as soon as I reached out, you know, immediately I said, sure, yeah, we can do this. Absolutely. You know, never said no, never showed any signs of a lack for confidence. Not that I had any. I knew that we could do it. But obviously, it was on me to make sure that that was carried off without a hitch. But when that service came through, you know, we really worked hard to expand it because it was so much better than editing 10-page papers or a resume or even like a 100-page dissertation. You know, now we had a 200-300-page book. The subject matter was way less rigorous than an academic paper and such. So it was easier to edit. It was more fun and also just a bigger marketplace, right? So everything made sense about going into books at that point. But it was a step at a time. You know, first we were just editing. We had no idea about ghostwriting or anything. And it wasn't long before they had a book that they sent to us for editing. And we just said, look, we can't edit this. This is in such bad shape. We can't do anything with it. And they said, oh, well, can you rewrite it? You know, we'll pay you more to rewrite it. And I said, okay, sure. Yeah, we could definitely do
that. Can we do that?
Yeah, we've never done that before, but I never told them that. You know, I said, oh, of course we can rewrite it. And then that led to ghostwriting. And then at some point, when we were doing a lot high volume of this stuff, you know, as soon as we started doing it, right, then we started advertising for it. As soon as we did the first book edit, okay, now we can start saying to other people, okay, we've edited books for publishers. We've written books for publishers. Now we're a ghostwriting company too. And as soon as they got into ghostwriting, though, then I really, at that point, and even before then, I really wanted to split the company. So they didn't want to have ghostwriting anywhere to do with, you know, academic stuff. And also it was just, we're going in two totally different directions, right? We didn't want to be a company that just did everything. So I split the company into different, you know, I hired a CEO to run the academic company. And actually we niched further on that too. We just went to the bigger ticket stuff. So that company, which is still a company, dissertation editor, and they have an office in the UK called thesis editor, because they call dissertations theses there. And a CEO runs that company and they just focus on statistical analysis and editing and academic advice on dissertation, PhD level stuff. So that was one company. And then this company, Kevin Anderson and Associates, that was the one where we're just, that's where I went with for my day job and just focused on books, just ghostwriting and editing books. But I mean, that's how that came, was just really just opportunities that would come up, just saying yes and figuring out how to do it and making sure that you're just, you know, giving a good service. And then once we had done it, then we could start to advertise for it and start to go out and knock on other doors, knock on other publishers' doors, say, hey, we're doing this for this publisher. We could do it for you too. And just expanding that way.
Yeah, you see that. I mean, you see that in so many different businesses. I mean, we built a business on life insurance brokerage. And next thing you know, we start creating content, telling stories. And then a CEO calls us one day. He's like, hey, what you're building, can you do that for me? So I kind of liken it in that scenario of what you're talking about. And you talk to a lot of business owners that, and that's what I talked about with the market. Like, someone calling the market, one person could call you and say, hey, can you do this? And then you think about it, you're like, well, wait a second, perhaps we can do that. And then we do it. And then to your point, then you just compound on it. But somehow they came across you. Either they knew you, they knew someone, they came across a social media post, a website, they'd heard about you, word of mouth. I don't know. Like, do you know how that original person got to you? Because I do think this happens quite a bit. And I mean, geez, you could be a soccer trainer and that could lead to the next thing that you get hired to be a coach for an MLS team. You're now the goalkeeper coach for the Columbus Crew, right? Like, do you know how that first person got to you? Because I think that's a very interesting way to look at it for anyone to learn from.
Yeah, I do to some extent. I mean, we were advertising on Craigslist of all things a lot, like back in like 2007. And we were putting it out there, like, what was our skill set? Well, okay, we were, you know, Harvard English and philosophy, doctoral students or graduates. And, you know, and then we would list the services that we could do, but we definitely made it clear about who we are, what we were. And the first person that saw that, and I remember where I was too, I was in the computer lab at the university when that email came through. I remember it distinctly. And they came up with the service, not us. I never even thought about doing an edit online and sending it, you know, but they knew who we were. And so they came up with it. And I think the idea was like, just to make sure that you turn that into something, like let that light bulb go off and jump on it. You know, we could have just done that one-off service and never advertised for it, never went after it again. Those opportunities weren't just going to come around. We were lucky that it came around, but after that, we went after it, right? We started, from that point on, we started advertising all over the country. Right? Like we would have just stayed local. They found us remotely as soon as we figured out, oh, right. Like we could do this anywhere. You know, I think jumping on that and testing the waters and started advertising all over the country, that made a big difference. And then, you know, with the book one, you know, I think again, we were very clear on who we were and what we were. And we were out there. I mean, we were definitely putting our name out there in editorial service, classifieds, like anywhere we could put our name out there just in terms of editing. But we just didn't realize that we were going to catch books. You know, it just didn't come to mind. But of course, as soon as the first person that came to us with a book, then, you know, every single ad after, you know, had it books, you know, and we changed the website. We changed everything. But we definitely followed the market. I mean, we got out of resumes. It was too low price, too high volume with low sticker price. It was a management nightmare. We got out of all the smaller scale stuff because it was just too, you know, we followed the lead to what made the most sense market-wise. And we changed our company dramatically year after year. Same with when we hit the New York Times bestseller list for the first time. You know, that became like immediately we changed our whole marketing plan around that, right? Now all of a sudden we're a New York Times bestselling editing and ghostwriting company, not just another ghostwriting and editing company. And so just making sure that you're always just being aware of those things and jumping on the opportunities. And, you know, I'm sure we jumped on opportunities along the way that didn't work out. I can't think of any at the moment, but I know there were plenty where a light bulb went off and you said, hey, let's go after this. And then you know, it turns out it wasn't working out. And then you abandon it, right?
Yeah.
You go with the hot horses. But I think being open to those opportunities and jumping on them, and if they make sense, then really try to double down on them and see if they pan out.
Yeah. Constantly iterating, pivoting, right? All those things, but not just for the sake of using and taking advantage of those words, but actually doing it. You've referenced Harvard a few times. And you used it to your advantage to talk about it when you're talking to the consumers, the people that might be working with you. Education, I brought it up before, like what education looked like, you know, and cost of college has gone up. Harvard's included, but no college has not continued to raise rates at ridiculous rates. And I don't know when you graduated, what it looks like, what would it cost then versus what it would today. But, you know, someone who's, let's say, intellectual, right? Smart guy, did a lot of things, built a business, have the Harvard pedigree, all that. Like, what are you looking at when it comes to universities today? The cost of college and what advice? It's not even advice to kids. Like, you know, there's a conversation to be had, like, do we even go to college? And do you go to Harvard? Do you go to an in-state school? Do you go explore somewhere else and go to a different part of the country? Like, every kid's different, right? That's the thing that I look at. And you're going to land at the place that you should land at. And just, we could go on for hours and hours. And there's a lot of books written about this stuff, right? But talking to you right now and, you know, referencing and coming from your vantage point of Harvard, like, where does that take you?
Yeah, one of our authors wrote a book called Blue Collar Cash, Ken Rusk. It was a Wall Street Journal bestseller. And it's all about, like, you know, thinking about blue collar careers and building really profitable and businesses around that without spending six figures on college necessarily. And just kind of questioning the value of these English majors spending $125K on a degree that they're never going to use, and then having to pay that back with interest, you know, for God knows how long. I mean, it's a real problem. And the Harvard, you know, I thought I was going to be a professor. I thought I was going to be a teacher. The business thing was never part of the equation. But at a certain point, I definitely shamelessly used that degree to help, you know, build a reputation. And so it's hard for me to say that that wasn't a major part of building this thing from the beginning and just earning that credibility. And so it definitely had a value for me. But when I think about college and stuff, like just from, it's like I got four kids, right? And there I got 2 9-year-olds, a 10-year-old, and a 13 going on 18-year-old.
Right. Good luck. Yeah.
And, you know, obviously I did a lot of school. I did 8 years of secondary school. But yeah, my message to them is definitely, I don't carry that torch and say, this is the way you got to do it. Because honestly, there's so many ways to have meaningful careers without going to college or doing a blue collar career. And we need blue collar workers. Like we need the hands-on workers desperately. And a lot of tech related stuff. I mean, you look at all the big tech guys that dropped out of college, you know, famously Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates. Bill Gates was actually the commencement speaker when I graduated.
Wow. Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of these people, their skills don't necessarily come from the college, but the college can really help your network in building those connections. Mm. And it does have some credibility to it. However, my advice for what it's worth is, yeah, spending big money on an undergrad makes no sense to me. I mean, my kids, I'm telling them to all go to Canada to go to college because it's way less expensive. It's great education. And if you do really great in your undergrad, graduate programs are not, like, I mean, they look at where you went to undergrad, but if you're going to a major school and you absolutely aced it, you're going to put yourself in a good position to get into a great grad program if that's the direction you want to go to. I don't think that there's that big of an advantage to spending 60, 70 grand a year on tuition at a high-end undergrad when you could spend a fraction of that and really stand out among your peers at a smaller school and then, you know, apply to a graduate program thereafter. So I don't know. I think you really got to think about it, though. I definitely push back against this model where 18-year-olds are just expected to invest the next 4 years of their life in a very expensive school when they have no idea what direction they're going to go. And, you know, some people will say, oh, well, they'll figure it out. That's what college is all about. Well, that's an expensive lesson, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, these schools are so expensive. I just think pumping the brakes there a little bit and really making sure, I mean, I didn't know who the hell I was when I was 18 years old, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. We all have to remind ourselves too, because like we think about our kids and you're like, wait, when I was 18, you know, you got to think about what they just said, this crazy thing, right? Like they're 18 years old. They do these crazy things. Like they're going to 22 years old, right? It's like they say your mind isn't really fully developed until you're 25, right? Talk to psychologists about it. And it is fascinating. Or you have to decide on your major before you even show up on a college campus.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get it. Some kids can do that. And maybe it makes you think, right? I could argue it's like, well, it's making you think about what you want to do. Okay, that's not a bad thing. But at the same time, it's like the expectation shouldn't be that's going to be the next 4 years, because chances are you might change.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're taking core classes, and what does that do for you? You could go to a community college and do all that. So it's endless. I would imagine reading, well, you tell me, like, when did reading become a big deal for you as we're talking about young people right now? Was it when you were young? Is this in college? Like, when did this hit you? Like, and I guess you could say reading while in school because you're getting assignments to read, which we know a lot of people do not like that. I was one of those people. Like, I would rather read the book for myself, not because there's going to be a test on it later. But at the same time, like, when did that, because I would imagine reading's a big deal in your life.
Yeah, you know, my background was always more critical reading. You know, my background was more philosophy, literary criticism, and theory. I always liked debating and thinking through logic and why things are the way they are and questioning things. And, you know, I didn't read a lot for pleasure. It was more, well, it was for pleasure, but it was, you know, I wasn't the big novel reader. Like, I wasn't the person that was reading all the latest things on the New York Times bestseller list. And even as a skill set, you know, the editing was always my background. It was more like looking critically at words and kind of critiquing people's arguments and deconstructing them and trying to figure out how to say things more precisely. It was nothing that ever came naturally. And I think that was part of what made me good at is it didn't come naturally. I had to really think through it and wrestle with it. But that was my background, was much more critical thinking, philosophy. And even when I started the company, you know, when I would be getting hired for something, it was more on that side of things, like how to, you know, how we think about language and how we edit and editing language. I mean, it was all English related, but it was never kind of really focused on books at the time. You know, over time though, I definitely read a lot of longer form, but it was always kind of more in that nonfiction side of things. Mm-hmm. But again, like that didn't stop us from hiring people that were brilliant novelists and novel editors and writers. And, you know, knowing that the need was there, just because it wasn't my skill set didn't mean that we can't do a great job with it. So
sure,
there was definitely a big need for that, for memoirists, you know, so that, you know, we brought those on really early in that process. As soon as we went into the book side of things, you know, we were getting people that were experts on all the different subjects yeah. that people write books about.
Yeah. Do you see it, like, you talk about editing, writing, reading, all these different things, right? You talk about an English degree before. I mean, there's a lot that could be said where if you do have an English degree, and I'm not speaking about college here necessarily, but like, I've noticed myself, the more I've read and the more I've like thought through things and gone through it and wrote things down, that it's helped me connect so much, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you're agreeing with it that like, and you know, pushing back, so like, let's look back at the younger generation again to that, the importance of doing these things, of reading and writing. I've always liked it when my kids got a writing assignments, like reading and writing assignments. I'm like, mm-hmm. just do as much of that as you can. Cause I've seen kids come out of college and they'll come work and they got A's and B's in writing and English class and they can't write honestly to save their lives. Mm-hmm. Like very scary. I'm like, where would you get A's and B's on? And then you have an editor look at it and just, you know, editors, right? Like very, very honest, very truthful, like right in your face and
right.
disheartening to these individuals that thought they were good writers. But anyway, you could go yeah. in any direction with that. But the reading and writing part is obviously like you're seeing it.
Oh, it's so important. I think my daughter is my, you know, I'm her least favorite editor because
I love it.
Yeah, I've got to really fight for that spot to allow to look at her essays and stuff. But you know, it's interesting because right now everything's information so fragmented and people are just getting like little bits and pieces. It's a tweet mm-hmm. here. It's like a short form article there that you only read like the bullet points anyway, because you notice that, oh, this is going to take me 10 minutes to read. I don't have time for that. So you look at right. this, the bullet points, and you know, the practice of writing or reading something longer form and just really bringing the whole picture into it is so important. And I'll see this with a lot of writing where people are just spewing out little bits and pieces, and every little piece, like there might be factual information or things might be right about every little piece, but they don't hang together. And so just that process of thinking through, okay, what is the thing I'm wanting to say? How does it all fit together? How does it all make sense? What's the through line that brings us all together? I mean, that's so important in rooting what it is that you're saying and actually believing in it. Because if you're just getting little pieces of truth here and there and everywhere, like every single one of those things might be true. But how you hold it all together in a cohesive whole is actually the most important part. Like, where does it fit into everything? Mm. And I think it's really dangerous, in especially the way that we consume knowledge and that we share knowledge right now is really scary because it's all snippets, you know? And like everyone has to interpret how this fits into the whole. And people are just so sloppy. It's all gotcha and these little plugs. And those are what are ringing true for people. And they're making big assumptions based on very little information.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that practice of reading long form and understanding what it all means together and also expressing yourself, you know, like what is it that you're trying to say and coming up with counterpoints, coming up with a bigger picture, figuring out how it all holds together is so important. And, you know, when people are writing books, I mean, some clients that come to us, especially corporate clients, corporate history clients, or clients that have a message that they want to share, whether it's business or personal development or self-help, a lot of times the practice, well, sometimes they come to us just to try to get all of their ideas into some sort of cohesive structure, right? Like that process alone is so formative for a lot of our clients, just getting all of the bits and pieces into a narrative, into a story, into something that has a table of contents where everything relates to everything else. And it all is part of a cohesive whole that you can believe in. And that has a message that you can take home. So yeah, that's why books are so important. You know, it's so much more important than just an article that is just doing one little angle, you know, like having something that really is trying to take in the whole and make it all make sense as a single unit, I think is just really, really important.
Yeah, it's concerning because you could look at TikTok, right? And say like your bite-sized content, YouTube shorts, Instagram reels, what have you. And it's hard to say, okay, if that's so exciting, right? To get that coming at you, then you're going to go pick up this book. And I get it, it could be digital, right? So you can get on a Kindle or you can listen on Audible. And that's tough to make that transition when you're waiting for, oh, wait, this is 10 hours or this is 300 pages, right? That's very complicated. Now, at the same time, there's more access to books now, right? There's more, you can get books almost anywhere. You can get them for free. You can do all sorts of things for younger generation to be able to, for anybody really, to be able to read. So I think maybe in some ways, I've seen studies on both sides. Like I've seen studies that say, people are reading more than they've ever read before. And I've seen it on the opposite. So I don't know what's true. Yeah. I guess we can argue both sides and who truly knows, because I guess it just depends on the people you ask, right? Mm-hmm. But it is concerning. And I also see on the other side of what you said of like putting it all together, like my father who ran a dental practice for his entire career, retired, and then was writing short stories. He was writing it for his high school, going back and putting all the stuff together. And it would become like real stories. Then it'd become fictional stories based, and they would take it on from there. Next thing you know, in his retirement phase, he's not retired anymore. He's a writer. And the amount of research and the amount of time that he puts into it and working with editors and working with us as we help him publish it, and more on the self-publishing side of things, right? What you do when you put that together is so rewarding, but it's a lot of work. And it's not just writing, it's reading, it's research, it's, I mean, conversations. I mean, it's endless, and it takes months, if not years, to go through that entire process.
But
a rewarding experience at that.
It definitely can take a long time, but definitely rewarding. And one of the things too that you see with writing is it forces you to put something down. And when you're putting it down on paper and looking at it in black and white and then reflecting on that, I mean, that's a very formative process, right? It forces you to really define what it is you think and how you think it. And so that process of writing really helps you to articulate and formulate exactly what it is you really are thinking inside, because it's, you know, emotions don't have words all the time, right? But putting, and thoughts and feelings don't always have words to them. Putting it down on paper, you know, there's lots of therapists that will recommend, you know, these process, and getting that down on paper and actually writing it out, you know, you face it, you have to face it, and you have to think about whether this is really what you think or not and why you think it. And it's amazing when you're trying to, when that process of writing, I mean, so many times you think you feel or think something for a certain reason, and you start to put it down on paper and you're like, oh my gosh, like this is actually not, this doesn't make any sense. Or you realize things about yourself that you didn't realize before. And we find that a lot of our authors, that experience of writing a book is just, you know, it's life-changing. They're different people and they understand themselves so much better at the end.
Yeah. We've had a lot of these different topics of writing and the formative change, right, that you just talked about, education, the social media, TikTok generation, all that kind of stuff. I don't think books are going anywhere. Books have been around a long time, right? Clearly, you don't see that as well. You're in the industry and you're getting a lot of new book deals and having a lot of success with that. But the future of the book industry is definitely interesting. And there's so many different ways to take it from the publisher side. And you also have from the consumption side, right? Because Audible's become this enormous business model. And people are listening to books. And it's amazing. Like, I've heard people talk about the unlock the Apple AirBuds have created, of like it can go for a walk, they can work out, and they can listen to a book where they can't just sit there all the time and read it. So you have those things. But at the same time, like I talked about before, you have YouTube, you have Netflix. I mean, it's funny too, because now I go to my Kindle on my phone and it almost looks like my Netflix, right? Because you have the cover art for all the books. It's just the end result of what I'm doing is actually more action on my side to actually read it, as opposed to sit on my couch or sit on a plane and watch a Netflix movie. But there's a lot in all of that. And that could lead to an entire podcast series that we could do, and we still wouldn't get to all of it. But like the future of the book industry, as it relates to everything I just said, like we'll take that where you want.
Yeah, you know, these are all good questions. And, you know, when books first started to go digital, the narrative that everyone was pushing was, oh, this is the end of physical books, right?
Yeah.
Everything's going to go digital. Why would you ever have a physical book when you can just have it in the palm of your hand? And that did not happen. You know, physical books still outsell digital by wide margin. Now, audiobooks has been really strong. And you can see why. I consume a lot on audio. And I'll put it on 2.5 times speed. And for certain books, you can make a lot of progress with that, with just an audio. Other books take a lot more time and to just really consume and reread those sentences over again and really think through it. It's hard to consume like a real dense, like philosophy text on audio. I mean, you can do it, but you're going to be hitting the back 15 a lot. And sometimes you just really need that time to just stop and think for yourself. Mm. Other books, you know, you can really whiz through them on audio, and it's a great thing to have because you can take it anywhere. In terms of the future of books, you know, we've been on a 30% year-over-year growth rate since we started, and we see that continuing on. I mean, people, the book is still such a powerful force in the world, but the way that people consume them is definitely changing. And so I think the future is definitely going to be going in, you know, I think you're going to see more audio forms. If you see this, you see a lot of this too, like Blinkist. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
It basically gives you the bullet points of a book.
Right.
It's like the 10-minute version of a book. Sometimes it's like 25-minute version of a book. You can see the value of these just in terms of getting information quickly and just getting the main value points from a book in a much more condensed way. And I will use that. I will use that too myself for books that I don't really want to read, but I do want to know what it's about and I do want to get like the basic points. But for me, and I mean, we'll see whether this trend continues for others, but for me, when I really want to sit down and read and consume a book, it's not my information consuming side. Like that I'll get from other sources. For me, it's more the meditative side. Like I'm actually spending time absorbing, engaging in the book. You know, it's an hour or two that I'll be sitting in the sauna or in a quiet place where, you know, that process is really where I want to go deeper and more meditative and reflective about what it is I'm consuming. So much information right now that we're getting, it's just hitting those endorphins, creating oxytocin. I mean, it's just like this, and that this is the way that TikTok and all of these platforms are designed, right? Is to just keep the juices flowing. They're not designed to have you reflect and think and absorb. They're meant to get you to keep you addicted, right? And just keep those
sell advertising.
Keep that synapses firing. And so, for me, reading a book is a totally different part of my brain, a totally different part of my experience. And hopefully the value in that is something, I mean, I think it's very human. I think it's very important, but and it seems like people are still very much, you know, taking the time to have that experience with a book rather than be seduced only by that, you know, kind of fast form content. But I think authors, and I think that's why you have Blinkist and you have these other, you know, the audiobook and why you have 3x speed, you know, I mean, it's for these people who they want to consume some of this content, but they just don't have, you know, they feel like they don't have the time or they're so used to getting things fast and furious that, you know, that those are appealing.
Yeah. The meditative state you talk about, and it's the experience, right, that you get. And there's a lot of investments going into turning off the device. And perhaps it's the book that's been around for thousands of years.
Yeah.
That could be the thing. And how do you make that transition to the book, right? To the physical copy of the book or the Audible or something. And for me, it could be both, right? That's where I was like, hey, if I'm going to pick up my phone and I'm going to have a habit of picking up my phone, I want to at least try to have the habit of maybe hitting the Audible or hitting the Amazon Kindle button or whatever that book thing app on my phone is. It's like, okay, that's at least a better habit. If I'm going to pick it up, let's read for a little bit as opposed to go to social media and all those things. But there's definitely a lot of money going into that. And then the other side of it, right? And the additional, and this has been happening over the last year, is AI, right? And so now you have books being published with AI. You have reviews being done with AI. I mean, who knows, right? There's a whole review culture on Amazon. I know New York Times bestseller, which you talk about a lot. I mean, there's a lot of conversation out there and AI is going to be at the forefront of all of it.
Oh yeah.
I'm sure it's very confusing because if AI is helping you be more efficient and perhaps being a first level editor, whatever that might be, like there's absolutely uses for this. But coming from your perspective, what are you seeing with AI over the last, I mean, geez, it's been going on for longer, right? You know, Grammarly exists and all those forms of AI, but this next level is a little bit different.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's a sliding scale, right? I mean, I think Microsoft Word, the very first version, you know, would put a little red line underneath your phrase to tell you, hey, you know, you got to rewrite this because it doesn't make any sense, right? They could tell that the grammar didn't make sense. Sometimes it was right, sometimes it was wrong.
Yeah.
But that's a kind of a form of assisted writing already. Now, where we're at now, you know, it is scary in some ways because, you know, AI is being used maliciously and dishonestly to generate content in a wide scale. And it doesn't do such a great job as we've seen, but it sure is definitely a tool. And it's something that I don't think, like with all this kind of with progress, you just can't ignore it, right? I mean, if you ignore it, you're going to die by it. Mm. That doesn't mean we embrace it wholeheartedly, but we got to figure out what it is and how we should approach it and how we can build safeguards and awareness about what makes sense and what doesn't. And, you know, this is all very, very new right now. So from the book writing perspective, AI, it only has access to what is already in the soup, right?
Yeah.
So AI could write a book on like the history, maybe you could write that history of firefighting book.
Yeah.
You know, if all those books have been submitted to AI, it has access to all that content and all those articles that have been written, you know, it could probably do a pretty good stab at writing the history of firefighting. But what it can't do is tell me Eric's life story. It can't tell me the things that made you over the course of your life unless it has access to your mind. And also, the other big limitation with AI and telling stories is that it's not a professional interviewer. So for instance, if I'm talking with you and I'm trying to get out your story or your message that you want to share, a lot of my job is to check your expressions, to see when I say something, how you react, to see if there's more there that's underneath. Maybe I even leave that for another day and bring it up when the time is right at another moment where I know that you're more vulnerable and you'll come out with a little bit more than what you did before. I mean, there's a lot of skill that goes into like a therapist or psychologist that AIs just can't replicate when you're reading people and you're also, you know, trying to find what the real story is underneath it all. You know, because a lot of times with writing someone's book, you discover things within that interview process that no one knew were there, you know, from the beginning. And so this is something that AI just can't do.
Yeah.
Now, could it still be a tool? You know, absolutely. I mean, there's so many ways it can be a tool and should be. And look, we have to progress, right? I mean, we have to figure out how to use it as a tool so that we're more efficient and better writers. I mean, we want to have better books, and AI can help us create better books, but there's just limitations to the types of books that it can produce and how it helps us to produce them. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, like on the base level, ethically, obviously, you know, writing a fake book, stealing content from other sources and claiming it to be original. I mean, there's a lot of problems with this. The other big problem with AI-generated content is if it is using existing material and sources, including published sources, you know, those sources aren't getting credit oftentimes, and they're not getting compensated for their ideas being reprocessed into this AI version of the book. So there's just some things we need to kind of think through of what, you know, when it comes to rights to material, when it comes to compensating people for their ideas and crediting them for their ideas. I mean, there is some, obviously, history with this in academia, citing sources and making sure that things are very clear where they're coming from. But right now with AI, it's a little bit of the Wild West. And if it is using existing published work or ideas or original thought and not sourcing them and using them to create something that's selling, and, you know, it's, there's some questions about who should be compensated for that material and who should be credited.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot to work out, I think, with AI. And I think we're just kind of figuring it out as we go.
Yeah, that's for sure. The conversation could keep going with AI forever. The last question I have is William Shatner, Tiger Woods, Joe Biden, Rafael Nadal, Gwyneth Paltrow, the list goes on, right? What are the beginnings of working with an author who hire ghostwriters with your company, right? What are the beginnings of those deals look like?
So most projects that come to us, well, I mean, there's a wide range, I guess, but I mean,
sure.
If it's a ghostwriting project, because, you know, some projects are just editing, they have a book already written and they just want us to review and improve it or what have you. But if it's a ghostwriting project where they're coming to us without anything written yet, there's an idea and they really need help. They're not a professional writer. They don't have time to write down every word, or they want a professional to help them bring out that book. A lot of times it's someone's agent, like for instance, celebrities or an agent will come to us and they, you know, they want to write their book. And so they come to us to get a professional writer. Other times they're just coming directly to us and they want us to help figure out the whole thing. You know, we get a lot of business leaders, a lot of professionals that want to have a book that shares their wisdom and their guidance on, you know, what they've learned and ensure that they're establishing themselves as like an authority in the space or just a piece that they can give to others to kind of contribute to their field. And in those cases, they're coming to us usually with a lot of ideas and sometimes little bits and pieces written, sometimes maybe a blog or something that's been done or interviews that they've done over the years, company corporate decks or something like that. But really everything else is totally unwritten and we're trying to figure out what the story is and how to tell it. And we're kind of guiding them through that whole process, right from the ideation and what the goals are for the book and how we can kind of create content around that, you know, before we kind of dive into an extensive, you know, research and interview process to get the core content.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Kevin, where do people connect with you? What do they learn about Kevin Anderson and Associates?
Yeah. I mean, their website's got a lot of information. That's kawriting.com, kawriting.com. Or you can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to hear from people. Connect with me on LinkedIn and I can figure out if I'm the best person. Usually it's somebody else at the company that can really help to get into the details of the book. But yeah, we're happy to help. I mean, we work with about 500 authors a year and we've got a great team that kind of brings these books from idea to published reality and bestsellers.
Yeah. And a lot of insights from you. That's, I mean, this is fascinating stuff for me, just like the reading, the writing, the publishing, the content production, all of it. So Kevin, I appreciate you coming on. sharing your thoughts and wisdom with us. And I really do appreciate it. Thank you again for your time.
Yeah, no, my pleasure, Eric.
In case you haven't noticed, we love podcasts. In fact, we love building podcasts, everything from development to production. Because of all that, we're building a one-of-a-kind podcast network. If you have a podcast or looking to launch a new podcast, then we should talk. You can message me on Twitter at Eric_Kaz or hit us up any way that works for you. Let's talk about your podcast joining this one-of-a-kind podcast network.